Welcome to Then and Now, a podcast by the UCLA Luskin Center for History and Policy. We study change in order to make change, linking knowledge of the past to the quest for a better future. Every other week, we examine the most pressing issues of the day through a historical lens, helping us understand what happened then and what that means for us now.
Welcome to Then and Now. I'm your host, David Myers, from the UCLA Luskin Center for History and Policy. The wars in Israel-Gaza and Russia-Ukraine consume much of our attention in the international sphere, at times occluding our vision from other grave threats in the world. Today, we will speak about one of them, the specter of nuclear arms proliferation and conflict. Early in the war with Ukraine, Russian President Vladimir Putin threatened to use tactical nuclear weapons. President Xi in China has made clear his strong desire to build up a nuclear arsenal that can rival that of the United States. Iran marches forward with its development of nuclear technology as it seeks to expand its regional power. Recently, it engaged in a missile attack on Pakistan, another nuclear power. And North Korea, according to experts, may be preparing to adopt a more confrontational stance that includes the threat of nuclear weapons. While our attention is trained on other conflicts, we are approaching the brink in several nuclear hotspots around the world. What has been done in the past to mitigate the threat? And what can be done to make the world safe from nuclear threat today? We're pleased to welcome to today's podcast Albert Carnesale, Chancellor Emeritus of UCLA. Chancellor Carnesale has had a distinguished career as a nuclear engineer, as an expert on nuclear arms proliferation, and as an academic administrator. He received his PhD in nuclear engineering in 1966 from North Carolina State University, where he taught until 1974 when he moved to Harvard. In the interim, he served as a member of the U.S. delegation to the Strategic Arm Limitations Talks, SALT I, with the Soviet Union. Meanwhile, at Harvard, Chancellor Carnesale served as Dean of the Kennedy School of Government, Provost, and Interim President. In 1997, he was appointed Chancellor of UCLA, a position in which he served for nearly a decade until 2006. He oversaw the growth of the university, notwithstanding a substantial decrease in state funding, and the passage of Prop 209, which banned affirmative action in state institutions. Upon stepping down as chancellor, he began to teach in the Luskin School of Public Affairs and the Samueli School of Engineering at UCLA. Over the course of his career, Chancellor Carnesale has been tapped to serve in leading positions on government commissions and committees dealing with nuclear arms and nuclear power, including the Scientific and Policy Advisory Committee of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency and the U.S. Department of Energy's Blue Ribbon Commission on America's Nuclear Future. Welcome, Chancellor Carnesale.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
There has been a good deal of recent attention to nuclear arms, not only because of the threats that we face in the world today, but because of a film, the movie Oppenheimer. I'm interested to know if you've seen it, and if so, what do you make of it?
Well, I have seen it, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I think, by and large, from what I know, it was the main aspects were accurate. I think it's always useful to remind people that films like that are not documentaries, in that the dialogue is all made up. No one recorded all those conversations for actors to repeat. So it's difficult to attest to the veracity of the conversations that took place. But in terms of events, it's consistent with what I know. And I knew I never knew Oppenheimer, but in later years, I knew several people who had been involved in the Manhattan Project. And from what I know, it was consistent with that.
And I'm just wondering, how do you assess the significance of the work done that is described in that movie? Some would say it's the most important development the world had seen to that point. How do you understand it, given your background as a nuclear engineer, someone deeply devoted to the proposition of controlling nuclear arms proliferation? How do you understand that moment?
Well, one important aspect of it to recognize is, had it not been done in the Manhattan Project, doesn't mean it would not have been done. It was well known that there was this phenomenon called nuclear fission, and it could produce large amounts of energy. And the question is, could you control it in a way that you could either produce power, like electricity, or produce a massive explosion intentionally, as opposed to the nuclear reactor blowing up? And the question was, how could you do that? And to do it as rapidly as possible, they thought at the time, because they were concerned that the Germans might beat the Nazis, might beat them to it. And many of the people who worked on the bomb project were indeed refugees from Europe who had fled the Nazis. So that was the dominant thrust for why this had to be done quickly. But had it not been done, it just would have been done a few years later, probably by the U.S. first, but later.
Who else was in the game other than the Germans at that time?
Well, we were quite concerned initially that the Germans were well into the game, but it turned out Hitler was not too crazy about this program, thought it was too long-term to invest all that money. So, and it looks like there was at least one error in what they were doing. And it's always been questioned, was that intentional or was that accidental? So they didn't get very far with their program, even though fission had first been observed in Germany. The science was done there first. The Japanese were not in the game. So it was really the British and us, and the British were involved in our program. So it was not so much an independent program on their side, but we had Britons involved in our program, some of whom turned out to be Soviet spies.
Where was the Soviet Union in this?
Now, they were just following our program. They had some good scientists working on it, but they had very good intelligence. And so they knew what we were doing, but couldn't take the resources at the time. I mean, the resources we applied to this problem were extraordinary, not just in terms of money, but also you had to be protected. For the Germans to do the Oak Ridge facility at which we enriched uranium at the time was the largest building under one roof in the world. You couldn't have built that in Germany or Japan, or for that matter, in most of Russia, because it would have been bombed. It would have been observed and bombed. So the size of the building, the electric power it consumed, Tennessee Valley Authority had just gone online, and this facility used almost all of that electricity. So it was quite a remarkable program to enrich the uranium. And then we had other facilities, reactors at Hanford in the state of Washington to produce plutonium.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to turn our attention away from the Manhattan Project to you and your really interesting career. You were trained as a nuclear engineer. You taught at North Carolina State and at Harvard. Then you became an academic administrator as dean, provost, interim president at Harvard before coming to UCLA. And as you were sort of making your way up the ranks in academic administration, you would also find yourself pulled into government service, serving on commissions and committees related to nuclear energy and nuclear arms. I'm just wondering how you came to that mix. Like, when did you know, I'm not just going to do nuclear engineering, I'm going to sort of step out and get involved in sort of the policy and praxis of it, not just the theory?
Well, I'd like to attribute it to brilliant planning, but too many people know the truth, so I wouldn't be able to get away with that. I was teaching nuclear engineering at North Carolina State University, which at the time was one of the leading universities in that field, because people had come from the various national labs from the Manhattan Project. And a group had come from Oak Ridge, which is in Tennessee, but they went to North Carolina State. Matter of fact, North Carolina State was the first university to have a reactor, which was a test. So it was a place that I got my PhD there and stayed to teach there. And I thought I was due for a sabbatical. I thought I might go to Washington and work on safeguards for the Non-Proliferation Treaty, because I didn't know anything about nuclear weapons, but I knew about nuclear power. And a big aspect of safeguards was to make sure that materials and technology from civilian nuclear power were not diverted to weapons. So I didn't know much about weapons, but I knew about civilian. So I did for what was to be a one-year leave, and I went to work with what was then called the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, which was under the auspices of the State Department. It was in the State Department building in Washington. And I was given the information on a program that they were funding someplace, and I looked at it in a couple of days, and I wrote a memo and said, this is not possible. They're not going to be able to do this, and explain why. And my supervisor's supervisor came out a couple of days later and said, you're coroner's cell, right? I said, yeah. He said, well, these talks are going to start next month on strategic arms control with the Soviet Union. How would you like to work on that? And I said, well, I don't know anything about nuclear weapons, and I don't know much about the Soviet Union. He said, that's okay. I read your memo. You'll learn. And so that was the planning that went into that. And so I wound up initially doing analysis to back up the negotiations. But after the first session, I was then became an advisor to the head of the delegation, then your senior advisor. And we couldn't even agree with the Soviets on a neutral site. So our neutral site was Vienna, theirs was Helsinki. And we would hold some sessions in Helsinki, Finland, some in Vienna, Austria. And when we were home, I would be assigned to the White House National Security Council staff to help write our instructions for the next session of negotiations. So it was all brilliantly planned. And then when I went, when the SALT I, as it was called, Strategic Arms Limitation Talks and then Treaty of the First Agreement, I went back to North Carolina State, but to head up an interdisciplinary program rather than back to my professorship in nuclear engineering. And I was only there a year when I got a call from somebody I'd known from, met in Washington, but it was from Harvard. I could get more into that, that Harvard had this new program on science and international affairs. Would I like to come and work on that and be associate director?
Before we get there, I want to go back to your time in Washington. You're 34 years old. You're taking a sabbatical. You write a paper on one topic, and the next minute you're being pulled into what is arguably the most important set of negotiations the United States had engaged in decades. What was the mood? What was the sort of the sensibility of those involved? Was it a time of grave concern over the imminent end of the world as a result of the nuclear arms race? Was there a sense of optimism? And if so, how so, if you couldn't even agree on a site for the negotiations?
Well, it was quite mixed views. Realize that a delegation like this, so even the discussions in Washington about this, involved the Department of Defense, the civilian Department of Defense, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Central Intelligence Agency, the State Department, this Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. And needless to say, you had quite a diversity of views on this. So the Defense Department is actually quite concerned about constraints that are going to be put on their arsenal, and they're worried about that. The intelligence people are worried about, will we be able to verify any agreement? Can we be sure that the Soviets will adhere to it? The State Department takes a view, well, at least we might be able to reduce the uncertainty about the threat through the verification procedure. So different people have different views, even among those that worked on it. But I don't think any of us who were worried about the world was going to blow up next week, but most of us did realize that we were working on something that was really important. And I remember, since I was new to this and relatively young among the people there, initially this sense that if I screw up, it could really be bad. And so a sense of responsibility that I had never felt before. I'm not one who gets stressed. So it wasn't a question of stress, but it was a sense of responsibility. I've got to try to do this right. And I've got to try to manage to convince these various people what to do. And I wound up being in the middle of things largely because I was pretty much a centrist. So the left wing, so to speak, the state viewed me as barely acceptable.
Who was the left wing? Can you just sort of...
Well, the left wing would have been the arms control and disarmament in this context, the people whose job it was to try and get arms control agreements.
And the right wing would be the Pentagon?
The right wing would have been the Joint Chiefs.
Joint Chiefs.
Where we don't want any constraints on our arsenal. And I was able to talk to both of them. So many of the first drafts of things were done not just by me, but a fellow, Jim Wade, who was in a civilian in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, because we were sort of trusted that we would get, you know, the draft right, where you had a hope of, with minor changes, it might be acceptable to all.
Was Henry Kissinger anywhere to be seen, his presence?
Oh, yes. Henry Kissinger was at the time the National Security Advisor to President Nixon. And this process back in Washington was, of course, coordinated by the National Security Council, which he was the head of. So the meetings in Washington at the highest level to decide, okay, what should our approach be, and the like, were shared by Kissinger.
And what was his disposition or attitude?
Well, he was pretty much open, my man. Obviously, I shouldn't say obviously. These talks probably never would have happened if Kissinger, and therefore Nixon, whom he was advising, didn't believe that this was worth a try. And then remember, Nixon, for all of his faults, you do have the opening to China, and you do have this attempt, can we control this? Now, not all the motives were noble, the world will come to an end. We were starting to get concerned about a race in defenses against nuclear weapons, largely because while they wouldn't be very effective, you would have to plan on the concept that the adversary's defenses might be effective. So you'd have to build up your offensive arsenal, and so would they. And this might lead to things really taking off. It was bad enough already, this race, but it could get a lot worse. And trying to reduce, and this, of course, was counterintuitive. I was amazed at how we were able to convince not just the Senate, but the American public, that it was a good idea to limit defenses. That is not intuitive. But because of this action-reaction, people were able to understand that.
So in thinking of this chess game that you're playing in, like building up defense will lead to the need for greater offense, how would you assess the players on the other side of the board, your Soviet counterparts?
Well, they had very much the same concerns, because if you look at your own forces, always like to say, you know, in the most conservative way, that they are, you know, their vulnerabilities, you know, their weaknesses, and you look at the other side's forces in the most pessimistic way, you know, how good might they be? And the Soviets, same thing. They looked at it the same way. They were as concerned, and that's why we were able to reach agreements.
Mm-hmm. And how would you assess, you know, from the distance of 50 years, the impact of the SALT I and SALT II negotiations?
Well, I think they were very important in the sense that they were the first ones. And then they were succeeded by other arms control agreements that brought the numbers down. What SALT I really accomplished, its main accomplishment, was the Ballistic Missile Defense Treaty, the ABM Treaty, Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. And so we managed to avoid this escalation that would come by each side building substantial defenses, because it limited defenses very severely. And I think it's both sides understood this, and both sides knew that you wouldn't really be able to defend, because the other side could build up its offenses. So we're able to avoid that. On the offensive weapons side, is what it did was essentially put a freeze. It was called an interim agreement. It wasn't a treaty. It was an executive agreement, although while it wasn't a treaty and therefore didn't have to be approved by the Senate by a two-thirds majority, the agreement on offensive weapons, it was submitted to Congress just for a vote of approval. And it was overwhelmingly approved. The ABM treaty was a treaty. I forget. I think the vote was 98-2 or something like that. So it was overwhelming. By the way, a large part of that was because the American public tended to trust Republicans much more on national security issues than Democrats. And this was an unambiguously hawkish Republican president. And that helped a lot.
And would you say that the foundation laid by SALT I and SALT II have largely held?
Yes. We have far fewer nuclear weapons today than we had at the peak between us. It's still far more than make for a safe world, but it's a lot less than, say, 10,000. It's closer to 5,000. At its peak, it was 50,000. So that's... Yeah, between the two of us at one point, counting what are called theater nuclear weapons or tactical, counting all the small weapons and the big ones, it was close to that number at its peak.
And what do you think explains the constraint? We live in a world in which constraints seem to be tossed out the door left and right, in which rhetoric and passion and jealousy and competition drive countries or groups to horrific violence. What's your best understanding of why here there has been a measure of constraint? People have really understood the stakes at hand and realized that not only can they destroy their enemy, but they will be destroyed as well. Is it the doctrine of mutual assured destruction?
Right. There were a small number of people who were constantly looking at, if you fought a nuclear war, who would, quote, win? Quote, unquote, well, win meant you came out, you were stronger than the adversary. So you had more. Others looked at and say, win? With, 100 million of our people dead? That's not winning anything. So people understood that this was different than warfare in the past. It was hard to imagine anything that was worth fighting a nuclear war over, given what the other side could do to your homeland. This is not like going to war in Vietnam, that the worst thing that happens is you lose, or a lot of young Americans die. But the homeland's going to be fine, thank you. Or just virtually all the wars we have fought, this was different. This, you have to say, well, as a matter of fact, it's one of the problems of trying to assure other countries that we will come to their aid, right, in NATO, if they are attacked, say, by what's now Russia or the Soviet Union. Because there's always the question, but the Soviet Union could then attack New York and Los Angeles. Would you be willing to trade New York and Los Angeles for Berlin? To which the answer, if you asked most Americans, they would say, no, thank you, no. So that's the hard part, is maintaining the credibility of extended deterrence, which is extending our nuclear umbrella to other countries, and making that credible is hard because, again, it's counterintuitive.
Mm-hmm. So The world we've been thinking about that begins with the SALT one and two negotiations, the world in which the United States and the Soviet Union are engaged in competition, a world in which there are distinct Soviet and American spheres. In the late 1980s, in 1989, the Soviet Union collapses, and that bipolar universe becomes, for a brief spell, a unipolar universe, and then later a multipolar universe. Was that competition between the United States and the Soviet Union a better guarantee of stability than the multipolar universe we inhabit now?
Well, first of all, it was never a unipolar universe as it came to nuclear weapons. Russia inherited all of the nuclear weapons that the Soviet Union had. So while it was unipolar into many other forms of influence, economics and political attractiveness, for many reasons, there was one big kid on the block, and that was us. When it came to nuclear weapons, that was not the case. They still had the full arsenal that they had had before. So that didn't change. Now, if you're talking about, yes, but by this point, there were other countries that had nuclear weapons. And we had to take that into account. Well, we had to worry about that when it was the Soviet Union, too. And in fact, when we had the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, a big proponent of that was the Soviet Union, just as we. As a matter of fact, the main reason why the Soviet Union was so enthusiastic about getting a Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty is to make sure that we didn't give nuclear weapons to the Germans to help to deter the Russians. Because if you put in one sentence the term nuclear weapons and the term Germany, let me assure you, you get any Russians' attention immediately that no, or for that matter, any Frenchman's attention, no. So there was, that was something on which we could easily agree. And also, I mean, if you're going to be realistic about it, it is not hardly surprising that those with nuclear weapons think it's a good idea that others shouldn't get them, right? That's pretty simple. So, but that was while it was the Soviet Union. That was before the unipolarity, which came to influence many things, but not this.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so today, to shift our attention to the contemporary world, we have the following with nuclear arms: the United States, Russia, China, the UK, France, India, Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea.
Right.
Not to mention the threat of what so-called dirty bombs getting in the hands of sub-state groups. And I'd like to get your sense of the nature of the threat we face today. So let's begin with China. There was a report in the New York Times recently about President Xi's aspiration from the time he came to power to build up a nuclear arms arsenal that rivals the United States. Mm-hmm. Where do you see China today in the context of the history of nuclear arms proliferation and the attempts to control?
Well, China first tested a nuclear weapon, I think, in 1964. So this is not a new development, but what it is true is they have decided, until now, they appear to have been satisfied with what we would call a minimal deterrent, a relatively small number of nuclear weapons that any country thinking about causing them damage would think twice, because if they only had 100 or 200, if one of those made it to your country and took out your biggest city, that's bad news. But if it was five or 10, so they've been satisfied with a minimal deterrent. And by the way, from their point of view, I'm sure this was a minimal deterrent, not just against the United States, but against the Soviet Union as well. It's not as if they've been close buddies all this time. So now they have about 500 nuclear warheads, and we expect they're going to try and go for numbers like ours. And I think it's for a couple of reasons. One, is that they can afford to do so. It's an expensive proposition. And while we read about their economy not looking so good for the future, the fact is when you compare it to 20 years ago, it's great. So one is they can afford it. Secondly, unfortunately, it remains one of the metrics for who are the superpowers. And so they want to be a superpower. And so a large number of nuclear weapons. And I guess a lesser reason, but it still applies, is as we get more sophisticated and more capable militarily to possibly destroy their nuclear weapons before they get to use them, and therefore they might not serve as a deterrent. If you have more of them, of more different kinds, in more different places, that enhances the survivability of a deterrent force.
Right, and that story in the New York Times pointed out that that a great deal of effort and investment had gone into concealment.
Yes. Mobile.
Dummy bombs.
Right. No, there are all kinds of things that can be done. Of course, for us, the main thing that we did to ensure that was the ballistic missile submarines. These submarines, which even in the early days, the nuclear weapons on their 16 missiles had more explosive power than all of the explosive power of World War II on one submarine. And we had 41 of them. So that was the way that I'm sure we overdid it, but that was the way we guaranteed the survival. Other things, when things were tense, we would actually keep some bombers in the air all the time that carried nuclear weapons, which if you stop thinking about it, it's really a little bit crazy, but to ensure that the Soviets couldn't destroy those bombers on the ground.
And do you imagine, I know that you're not a China expert, but you are an expert on nuclear weapons and the way they are deployed, that China would use its growing nuclear arsenal to attempt to leverage action on Taiwan? Is that a possibility that we should be mindful of?
I don't think so, because I don't think they want to endanger mainland China for Taiwan. What it is it's a deterrent against us saying, if you do that, we will use nuclear weapons, to which they can say, really? And what do you think happens next if you do that? So it's a deterrent against us. But that's another one. It's like when I said Berlin, while we have this, policy of ambiguity, and would we actually come to the aid of Taiwan with troops and the like? Almost everybody believes we're not going to attack mainland China, nor are we going to put troops on Taiwan. Depending upon what the situation is at the time, we might lend naval assistance. We might try to prevent the Chinese from blockading Taiwan, maybe. But again, you get down to, as much as the American public and American politicians may speak in support of Taiwan, it's mostly about enabling Taiwan to defend itself rather than, don't worry, you can count on us.
Right. Okay, let's turn our attention to Iran, which, of course, was the subject of extended negotiations in the Obama administration that yielded the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, in 2014, which introduced limitations on the Iranian nuclear program. President Donald Trump pulled out of that deal in 2018. Since that time, it's assumed that Iran has made further progress on its nuclear program and has come very close to the ability to build a nuclear bomb. What does Iran conjure up in your mind, given your experience?
Right. Well, first, let me, in the spirit of openness here, I might not be considered entirely objective of this, in the sense that During the Obama administration, I was on the advisory committee to the Secretary of Energy, which are the people responsible for nuclear weapons, and I chaired the nonproliferation effort of that. So while I was not on the team that negotiated the deal, I was not going overseas to do that, I was involved in the shaping of that agreement. And I thought, even at the time, that there were understandable arguments by those who opposed entering the agreement. Understandable. In other words, I didn't think they won a day, but it had some merit. The most obvious, first let me take the ones that had no merit. You can't trust the Iranians. To which the answer is, that's true, but that's why you have agreements like this. We certainly didn't trust the Soviets. So that's a reason for an agreement with adequate verification provisions, right? A second traditional argument is, we can get a better deal. Well, anybody that's not in the negotiations can believe you could get a better deal. But we believe the deal that we got was about as well as you could do. And a third argument was that this doesn't solve a whole bunch of other problems that involve the Iranians. What about them supporting groups like the Houthis? Right, or Hamas, to which the response was, these negotiations were intentionally limited to the nuclear realm because we thought that was the most pressing problem, and we wanted them to give the most to us in our negotiation position in that realm rather than start trading off other things, and which it might get more difficult. So those arguments, each of them has, you can understand it, but I didn't think they were winning arguments. And I think the deal was was working very well, actually. They were supposed to, not only were there limits on their verification, on how much they would enrich uranium, but they were supposed to get rid of some of the uranium that they had enriched, and they did. So they were in full compliance. So I think if I try my best to think of, well, then why did Trump get out of the deal? The best reason I can come up with is because he said he would. I'm sure he hadn't read the agreement. I'm sure he's not the kind of person that would have brought together a group and said, well, tell me the pros and cons, and I'll decide. He only heard from people who gave him the cons. Initially, and then he said he would. So then even when he had an administration and he had national security advisors that knew better initially, or a Secretary of State who knew better, or a Secretary of Defense who knew better, he had already said that's what he would do. And he had led his base to believe that it was important to do that, that we would get a much better deal if he did that. And he did it. And of course, we're a lot worse off as a result. So the idea of that agreement was to keep the Iranians at least 1 year away from a weapon verifiably. So we can't tell if they're doing experiments with just explosives, but that aren't nuclear. Sometimes they might be able to conceal that. But we could tell how much uranium they were enriching. We had on-site inspection. We had more than the International Atomic Energy Agency usually provides. So we're confident that they were in compliance with the agreement and were at least a year away. Now, we can't say that anymore because now they have uranium that's enriched far higher. They have far more centrifuges that can be used to enrich it quickly. So we, in realistic scenarios, if you're trying to think, well, what about all the other things they have to do? If they went all out, it's hard to make the argument that it would take them more than 6 months to get one weapon. And the enriched uranium, they could have enough in less time than that.
So in thinking of that prospect, and particularly as Iran advances in its goal to become the leading regional power or a leading regional power and displaced the United States from its position in the Middle East. I'm thinking back to a classic work of your Harvard colleague, Graham Allison, on the rational actor in policymaking. Do you assume that the Iranians are rational actors and therefore, while they are moving forward with a program to build a nuclear weapon, can be understood to play according to the rules of the game as they've evolved over the last half a century?
Well, when you say assume they're rational actors, if I have to assign probabilities, I assign a higher probability to that than that they're not. That they're more likely that they're rational actors than not, by a good bit, I think. The leadership. There's every indication that they are homicidal, that they're prepared to kill people and send young people out. There's no indication that the leadership is suicidal. And what they value most is their power, their lives, the country over which they have power. So I don't think they want to do anything that might get the United States to really go all out against them. Number one. Number two, I think they're rational, as they certainly have not gone for nuclear weapons to try to get them as quickly as they could. They have not done that. They're not even doing that now. From what we can, I think what they want to be for a while, so long as it serves their purposes, is close. You know, and so that they don't have to take all the problems or worry about Israel trying to strike them, even though it might be very risky, etc. I think they'd like to be close and not. The deterrent there is for us not to push them into getting them. So I think they are rational in that sense, because rational is not the same as nice.
Well, I put this criterion of rational actor on the table, thinking back to Allison's work on the Cuban Missile Crisis, because of the next scenario that I want to introduce, which is North Korea, where I think it's less clear to many about whether there's a rational actor in charge. And I particularly want to call attention to the fact that two experts on Korea, Robert Carlin and Siegfried Hecker, recently stated that they believe Kim Jong-un has made a decision to go to war, diverge from the path of negotiation or the prospect of negotiation, and undertake a much more belligerent attitude towards South Korea and the world beyond. I'm wondering how you assess the North Korean threat.
Well, first of all, when you look at what the Kim family has accomplished, it's hard to argue that they're irrational. Here's a group that has stayed in power for a few generations and maintains control over one of the poorest countries in the world. And when we get defectors, they criticize the circumstances in the country, but they don't criticize the great leader. They do not attribute it to the leadership of the country. He has an extraordinarily loyal following within North Korea. It's all based on misinformation and indoctrination and all of it, and lack of access to other information. But I'm not talking about the reasons. If my objective is to stay alive, stay in control, and have a country over which I can have control, they've done remarkably well. And he's done remarkably well. So the evidence is, while he does crazy things by our standards, he doesn't do crazy things when it comes to his life, his power, or the survival of his country. So, I think he genuinely does worry that he needs a deterrent against the United States. And if you stop and think of it, if you're in his shoes, you'd probably agree with that, that if he didn't have nuclear weapons, we'd probably be a lot tougher on North Korea. Not infinitely so, because he can cause a lot of trouble to South Korea without nuclear weapons, just with artillery and the like. And that would deter us, but not as strongly as would the possibility of nuclear weapons. So I think I can believe He's inclined to take a much more aggressive stance, but I don't think he wants to start a war with South Korea. But I don't pretend to. But if he does, it will be because he made a strategic calculation that if he doesn't do it now, something bad's going to happen. So it will be a rational decision. We could agree with it. We could disagree with it. But I don't think it will be, gee, today's a good day to start a war with South Korea. I think I'll do that.
It's a very helpful perspective. I want to sort of pose a question as we move towards the end of our conversation that relates to what's known as the doomsday clock, which is a kind of risk assessment put out by a group of atomic scientists, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. And most recently, the doomsday clock declared on January 23rd, 2024, that we're facing a moment of historic danger. It's 90 seconds to midnight. Do you agree with that assessment? And can you situate that in some historical context?
Well, first of all, about the doomsday clock, either it hasn't been wound or the battery's been dead for a long time, right? So this is one of those things where this has been a prediction for a long, very rare. Sometimes it backs off a little bit. It never backs off an hour. It never, you know, it's a, so this is its end. I think what is true is that an all-out nuclear conflagration would be a disaster, And the more fingers there are on nuclear triggers, the greater the danger that it might happen. I don't believe those of us during the worst days of the Cold War, those of us worrying about this, there was a small group that worried, gee, the Soviet leadership might wake up one day and say, this is a good day to attack the United States. And that's very few of us. We guarded against that. We over-guarded against that. But we guarded against. We weren't worried about that. They would have to be suicidal, in which case, in another way. What we did worry about was all the ways that a nuclear war might start. Other than that, matter of fact, you mentioned Graham Allison. Of course, as you know, I work closely with Graham and with Joe Nye. And the first book that we did with some other Harvard colleagues was called Living with Nuclear Weapons, the story of which is the then president of Harvard brought a group of us together and said, look, you guys, you've managed to take two institutions at Harvard and have them work together and peacefully. Maybe you could do that. Could you write something about nuclear weapons that advanced high school students and college students could read? So a group of us, this was called the Harvard Nuclear Study, I guess, group, but it didn't include Graham, but it did include Joe, wrote this book called Living with Nuclear Weapons. The reason I mention it, because one of the main things that it did, in addition to talking about the arsenals and what might be done, it talked about the various ways in which a nuclear war might start beyond the bolt of the blue, suddenly you wake up and there's a war, whether it was an accidental launch that you saw and you responded to, or one that was unauthorized. Some colonel somewhere figured out how to do this, or the captain of one of the submarines was unable to communicate and thought, oh, well, a nuclear war had started, or proliferation, that it would be some other country. So we went through this long list, and that, then we had a conclusion of what might be done about it. But I think what was most helpful about it was the various ways in which a nuclear war might start. And those are getting worse slowly over time, far more slowly than we anticipated, because the more nuclear weapons there are and the more people that can use them, the greater those dangers are. I still believe that the danger of somebody waking up in the morning and say it's a good day for a nuclear war, very low. but it only gets higher with more countries might have nuclear weapons or accident or an escalation. If it's, let's say there's a conventional war and one of the countries in the war has nuclear weapons and is going to lose the conventional war. Will they lose rather than use their nuclear weapons? Unlikely. So it's all those other ways that a nuclear war might start that, to me, are the real danger. And that's one of the reasons why, while I continued to work on superpower arms control, I really shifted much of my focus years ago to the nonproliferation problem, to reducing, or not so much reduce, minimizing the number of countries that acquired nuclear weapons. And we've been extraordinarily successful slash lucky, right? Because I don't know who's there, but if you, John F. Kennedy, when he was president, the assumption was anybody, any country that could build nuclear weapons would. So that within the next decade, he said in the early 60s, you'd expect between 15 and 25 countries to have nuclear weapons by 1970. Well, it's now 2024. There are 9. Amazing. And if you ask how many countries could have built them, had they chosen to do so, I don't know. Maybe it's 100. And what about, isn't it very difficult to make? Not if you can get the enriched uranium. Building a plutonium bomb is a little complicated. Building a uranium bomb, the one we dropped on Hiroshima, was of a design that had never been tested. They were that confident that that simple design with enriched uranium would work. The one that was dropped on Nagasaki used plutonium, substantially more complicated design, and that was the kind that was tested at Alamogordo, New Mexico, to see, would this actually work? And that was the Los Alamos weapon, and getting back to Oppenheimer, that was the test. And Alamogordo, New Mexico, was of that plutonium bomb, would it actually work? And it did.
Well, we're in a far more complicated world, and your final remarks offer both hard-headed realism and a qualified measure of optimism, and we'll try and snatch the latter as we conclude. Thank you, Chancellor Albert Carnesale, for making time to be with us. It's been a really informative and stimulating hour.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Then and Now, a podcast by the UCLA Luskin Center for History and Policy. You can learn more about our work or share your thoughts with us at our website, luskincenter.history.ucla.edu. Our show is produced by David Myers and Rosalind Campbell, with original music by Daniel Reichman. Special thanks to the UCLA History Department for its support, and thanks to you for listening.